Hi, I'm Lauren Good. Nope, I hated that. 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Lauren Good.
And I'm Gideon Litchfield, and this is Have a Nice Future, a podcast about how terrifyingly fast everything is changing.
Each week, we talk to someone with big, audacious, and sometimes unnerving ideas about the future, and we ask them how we can all prepare to live in it.
Our guest this week is Lukas Ilves. He is the chief information officer of the government of Estonia, which people often talk about as one of the most digitally advanced governments in the world.
The fact that other countries in a couple of years' time can look at what we've done, learn these lessons, and then kind of catapult themselves into being the same league with us, that gives me ground for optimism that actually governments can get better at this.
So Gideon, I've heard passing references to Estonia as this magical, futuristic place where everything runs on the blockchain or something. But I have to confess, I know very little about Estonia. I am going to be the proxy today for audience members listening to this who are like, I know nothing about Estonia. Tell me.
That is your job.
That's my job.
Okay, well, so let me ask you something. In the last 5 years or so, how many times do you think you have filled in exactly the same information, your name, address, phone, email, social security number, health conditions, whatever, every single time you've gone to see a new doctor or applied for a driver's license or done pretty much any other bit of bureaucracy?
A lot. Hundred. You're saying within the past year? I can't even begin to...
However long, yes.
I can't begin to... remember, that's actually called adulting.
That's why it's so hard.
Yes.
So what if you never had to do that again? You show up at a new doctor's office or at City Hall or at the bank, and you just prove to them that you are you, and they say, okay, thank you, Ms. Good. Just tap here to accept our services, and we'll have all the data on you that we need.
So it's like Apple Pay for government.
Sure, if you want.
I think this is good as long as the data is secure.
Yeah. So what Estonia has is this advanced system for permissioning data. Different bits of the government and also different private companies all have data on you. But you can decide who gets to see which data from which place. This system they call the X-Road is basically a backbone for transferring data between different entities. And what's more, you not only can give permission to individual people or entities to see bits of your data, you can also see who has looked at it every single time. So you have total transparency into how your data is being used, which you certainly don't hear in the US.
Ah, that must be where the blockchain comes in.
Somewhere in there, the blockchain comes in, yes. Possibly the first use of a blockchain I've actually believed in.
Okay.
So let's go even further. Let's say you don't have to file your taxes.
I'm listening.
You just get a notification from the government that your tax return is ready. You take a look, and if it looks good to you, you click accept, and your taxes are done.
What if they don't look good?
Then you can change them.
Okay,
you can
put I'm just saying, if you have like a quibble about something,
yes.
Okay, I like the sound of this too.
And now let's imagine you're eligible for some kind of state benefit, like disability or an education grant or childcare. But you don't have to apply for it. You don't even have to know it exists. You just get a notification from the government saying you qualify for this thing. Do you want it? If yes, click here.
How does the government know you're about to have a baby? Are they spying?
No, but if it knows you've had a baby, if you've been to the hospital and registered a birth,
then they kick
in automatically.
Okay, so there's one side of this that sounds a little bit Big Brother, and then there's another part of me that thinks this is probably how a fully digitized government should work.
Right, it's kind of like Steve Jobs used to say about Apple products, it should just work.
Mm-hmm. And so Lukas's job is to make this all work.
Well, not his job alone, but he is the guy in charge of overseeing the digital transformation that started about 30 years ago and continuing to advance it across all the government.
Estonia is pretty small though, right? So to ask a question that, you know, perhaps a Silicon Valley VC would ask, can it scale? Is this something that the United States could conceivably do?
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to Lukas about, because Estonia is seen as this poster child for digital government to the point where it's kind of become a cliche. People say, oh yeah, Estonia, but good luck trying to replicate what Estonia does anywhere else. I basically wanted to ask Lukas how exportable is the Estonian model. And he seemed to think it wasn't as unique to Estonia as you might imagine.
Well, I can't wait to hear this.
And that conversation is coming up right after the break. Lucas Silvas, welcome to Have a Nice Future.
Thanks, Gideon. It's a pleasure to be on.
Are you having a nice future?
I am, although for me, it's my present.
I think most of our listeners probably have heard that Estonia is a pioneer in digital government, but they don't know much about what that means in practice. So can you briefly talk about the key things that make it a leader?
Sure. I mean, the headline point is really simple, which is just that everything's digital. There isn't a government service or an interaction between citizen or business and government that hasn't been digitized at this point. So everything from, you know, the mundane that should be digital at this point in pretty much every country in the world, like filing your taxes, permitting of any kind, to, you know, some things that are a bit less digitized in most parts of the world, such as voting, where we've been able to vote online since 2004. And in our most recent elections, more than half of people did. And of course, beyond just digitizing things, we have a very strong focus on taking advantage of all the sort of the tools that new tech gives us to constantly make stuff better, whether that's better from the perspective of transparency and accountability, convenience, or cost effectiveness. So in some ways, I'd say it's almost unremarkable. We do in government what pretty much everyone in the world everywhere does with digital transformation, which is to find ways to constantly get better at what they're doing using the technologies of the day.
Estonia's been on this journey of digitizing its government for about 30 years. So how did it get started? And why do you think it got a head start on so many other places?
Well, the interesting thing is we didn't get a head start. We had a very late start. So when did the U.S. start digitizing government? In the late 40s or the early 50s, with a bunch of mainframes. And even countries that, you know, you don't think of as being wealthy or super technologically advanced have been doing digital government, at least in the sense of having government mainframes running back office processes, since the 1960s. Estonia was, you know, forcibly occupied by the Soviet Union until 1991. And so, in a sense, a lot of our government processes were much more backward technologically. And when we regained our independence in 1991, we effectively had a clean reboot of a lot of how government functioned. And so we got lucky in timing. We started at a time where the thinking had just radically shifted in terms of what providing a service means. We were in the era of the internet. And the second is that we didn't have a lot of in the way of resources. So we couldn't just sort of take 1980s enterprise IT because we didn't have the ability to afford IBM and Accenture to come in and build that for us. And so, you know, initially a lot of what we did was sort of bootstrapped and sort of at the time fairly young tech guys figuring out very organically, well, what makes sense? What kind of fits our functional requirements?
Let's talk about some of the implications of what that actually means for users of government services. So Estonia has this principle that no piece of data should have to be entered twice. How does that change the experience for people compared with a country like sitting here in the US, every time you go to see a different doctor, you have to fill in forms all over again?
That's right. So that's what we call the once-only principle. If the government has asked you for a piece of data, they don't have a right to ask you for that same data again in a different context. So that means pre-filled tax declarations, where Estonians like to compete on how long it takes them to declare their taxes. And what they're really competing on is who's faster and logging on to the tax service, pressing accept and being done.
How long does it take then to file one's taxes?
If you don't actually look at the declaration, you can do it in about 15 seconds. So what's happening in the background there is that we have a pretty good taxonomy of the data that government has. And when one public body has a reason to use data, then they go and query that from another public body based on the legal authorization they have to use that data. But the benefits aren't just around convenience. It makes your public services work more effectively. It reduces a lot of error and a lot of the sort of difficulties in public service delivery where disadvantaged populations might not get access to a service because they don't know about some kind of an opportunity or an entitlement that you can sort of do away with. It reduces a lot of opportunities for fraud on the one hand, but also corruption on the part of officials. And it also, we at least think, makes us better at protecting our citizens' data, because instead of having, you know, massive amounts of data over-collected everywhere and generally not necessarily stored and safeguarded too well, you know, if we've got a piece of sensitive data, then we focus on keeping that well protected in one context, making sure the access rules are strictly enforced and making sure the right protections are in place, and then giving our citizens transparency on how that data is actually used.
So my sense from having visited Estonia a number of times over the last couple of decades is it's a pretty technologically literate country. But there will always be some people, especially the elderly, who find digital services a little harder to handle or who are especially vulnerable to hacking and having their data compromised. How do you help those people and how do you make sure nobody's getting left behind?
So there's a two-part answer. The first, of course, is how you actually build your digital services to address these problems, right? So, you know, it's a basic, first of all, user design question. Well, you can have very complex services that can still be easy to use or that can be a nightmare to use. And the same thing's true, for instance, for questions around identity theft or hacking. I mean, part of having a secure EID is it puts additional barriers in place to, you know, some of the usual ways in which credentials would get stolen. So for part of the elderly population, you're going to solve that question by having easy to use convenient services that don't create those problems. And by the way, it's not just an elderly question. If we look at the largest proportion of calls to our help lines are actually from people in the age bracket of 18 to 25, because a lot of how government agencies design services, even in Estonia, isn't really built for how Gen Z, you know, which only uses mobile devices, which has a kind of a different expectation of the user experience, how they're used to using services. So it's not always the case that younger means, you know, that they have an easier time using a service. But for the elderly, you're never going to hit 100%. You're always going to have people with, you know, enough cognitive or sensory impairment that they really can't use the service. You're going to have people who just refuse to use the service. And we don't force citizens to use digital services. There is always an in-person or paper alternative. But it becomes a numbers game. The idea is not that we move everyone into digitization, but that if we can move, you know, 80-20 or 90-10, the vast majority into digitized automated channels, then we use the resources we have to then deal with the other 5 or the 10% in a way that actually pays more attention to their needs and gives them better outcomes.
Right. So it seems like one of the big shifts that's happening at the moment in Estonia is a move to proactive public services. The idea that if you're entitled to some benefit, you shouldn't have to apply for it. It should just appear automatically. Where do you expect that to end up?
The idea is really quite simple, right? Which is that the triggering conditions for most public services are written in the law somewhere. It can be anything from as mundane as, well, your passport needs to be renewed when your passport expires, to something, you know, a bit more sophisticated like means testing for a public benefit. And if we know that we have the data that determine whether you are entitled to a benefit or should be using some kind of a service, then we're just kind of sitting on our hands if we don't reach out to you when those data or those events indicate something should be happening, right?
Right.
So the basic idea is just it's a convenience point. It's as simple as me getting an SMS saying, you know, hey, your passport's going to expire in 2 months. Here's the link to renew it. But as you then start going through more complex events and services, you get into situations where, you know, you're notifying people of benefits that they weren't aware that they're eligible for. You might in particular be focusing on disadvantaged populations where the information about the availability of these benefits isn't really there. Or you're pushing out things like, for instance, in the case of COVID, right, where we had additional unemployment benefits and health benefits and support also for enterprises, you're going to the people that these benefits are meant to target without waiting for them to come to you, which should be contributing to actually achieving the desired outcome, you know, the reason for which those benefits or those targeted forms of support were created in the first place more effectively.
Right. I mean, it seems kind of obvious, and yet in most places around the world, it's assumed that if you want something from the government, you have to ask for it.
Yeah. And I mean, there may still be, you know, asking for it. You know, I have to ask to have my passport renewed. But why shouldn't the government tell you that, hey, you can ask for it? Wouldn't you like to ask for it? Because again, all of these, you know, various forms of benefits and services, I mean, ostensibly they exist because they're in the public good and because the lawmaker wants them to be used. So if we're kind of funding something, we're creating the legal framework, and then we're just failing to tell our users that it's out there, that's really sort of, you know, doing 95% of the work and then failing in the last 5%.
Let's talk about online voting. This year, Estonians voted, and for the first time, more than half the votes were cast online. Tell us, first of all, how that online voting system works. What makes it secure?
Yeah. So the online voting we have in Estonia is actually quite similar to a mail-in ballot. The ballot itself, you have an anonymous ballot that can only be read and decrypted by the Electoral Commission after the voting's over. And that, in turn, is digitally signed using your electronic identity and your signature that Estonians use every day for banking and government services. And in practice, you've got a piece of software which you download to your desktop or from next year onto your smartphone, and you cast that ballot. It gets sent to the electoral service, and then once the voting period's over, it all gets tabulated and counted.
So it's a little bit like the digital equivalent of a paper ballot where you have a ballot inside an envelope, which is blank, and then that goes inside another envelope, which has your voter information on it.
Basically, with a bunch of fancy cryptography thrown in there, yeah.
There have been some claims over the years that the system isn't entirely secure. Various researchers have suggested that they've found flaws. And clearly, it's taken a while to build up public trust in the system, because it's only this year that more than half the population voted online. Given everything else that Estonia has been doing digitally, does it feel like this one is harder to get right?
About now, almost a decade ago, we open sourced the software. And of course, you know, researchers from across the world looked at that. And there was some, you know, they found some, you know, potential theoretical concerns. And there were a whole bunch of, you know, sort of observations about process that were made, which we then took on board. And we sort of, you know, worked through the software. We've made some updates. But at the same time, you know, there hasn't ever actually been any form of compromise that's been discovered. The flaws that have been talked about are all theoretical and generally also have a whole bunch of technical and organizational safeguards in place, so that even if any of these flaws that, for instance, were discovered, you know, would have been exploited, that wouldn't have actually impacted the integrity of the electoral process. Making these elections secure, ensuring the integrity of the process, ensuring the secrecy of the ballot and so on has always been the number one design consideration. And the slow uptake, I'm not sure it's about trust. I mean, initially it was seen kind of as a geekish oddity. And, you know, people don't vote very much. There's also, for a large part of the population here as elsewhere, there's an element of ceremony to, you know, going into your local polling booth. But it's been one of those services where the uptake, it follows an exponential growth curve, but it just takes time.
Obviously, the big meta question for all of this conversation is how easy it is for other places to do what Estonia is doing. And particularly sitting here in the US, a lot of the stuff that you're describing sounds science fictional, just because it's hard to imagine anybody agreeing to a single centralized ID where that allows all your data to be shared across different government agencies, for example. But you lived in the US for a bunch of years. What do you think it would take for some of the stuff that Estonia is doing to be replicated here?
Yeah. So before I get to the US, let me say that bunches of countries have copied what we've done, or they've taken inspiration, big and small. You know, on the big side, India, and a lot of how they thought about the India stack was really inspired by what we did. Some countries have really copied quite directly what we've done. So, you know, most recently, most notably, Ukraine's digital transformation, I think, was kickstarted by being inspired by us, and a lot of the ways in which they've rebuilt individual services based on what we've done, their data exchange platform is basically our X-Road, and so on. And there's a long list of examples. So this does transfer, and what's been done in Estonia can be done, you know, is being done in every continent of the world. Now we get to the US. I'd say that what I've found to be most detrimental to all this transformation, and you see this in the US, you see this also in a couple other countries, I'd say Germany and Japan, is a self-defeating attitude of, well, we shouldn't even try because we probably can't pull it off. And in the US, that takes the form of deep pessimism about the capability of the public sector to do things differently. I would say the most important thing is to actually not fall into that sort of trap of prejudging yourself to failure. Mm. In English-speaking countries, perception that the government really shouldn't be handing out identities.
It's seen as a bigger brother thing.
Yeah, but you see as a result of that politicians in these countries, in the U.S. included, haven't really fought that fight. I mean, I think the way that digital identity is probably going to happen in the U.S. is going to be that the actual sort of technical layer is probably going to be done by tech, and then there's going to be an interface probably with states on how you actually take, you know, the certificates and maybe even the secure hardware in your iPhone or your Android device and link that to identity credentials. And I think basically that's what Apple and Google are working on already. So I think that probably EID in the US is actually going to sort of solve itself by the back door without anyone even realizing that it's been solved. What that will require is enough people, more I think in state government, but with support from the federal government, having the courage to do that and sort of get over the initial hump. And the best thing to get over the hump is actually putting services into users' hands that they really like. You put something that works, that's fairly easy to use, and that also has some transparency on, you know, what it's doing with the data into someone's hands. And I think that most people say, hey, this is great. I'm really happy it's made my life easier. And if in the background the work has been done to convince the privacy advocates, et cetera, who would be really concerned about it, that actually this passes muster, you would hope they'd sort of listen to the signals. I realize that's hopelessly naive given the political polarization in the US, but that still sort of should be your starting point.
Do you worry about Estonia starting to fall behind, having been the leader in building these digital systems for so long, as other countries come in and innovate in their own way?
So I don't worry about us falling behind, sadly, in part because this is tough to do across government everywhere. And so while we do have plenty of competition, we don't have as much as I think we should. But also because, you know, our main goal is to make stuff better here. So stuff that keeps me up at night, it's not, will another country be better than us? Will all the sort of normal bureaucracy of government and all the sort of mundane challenges we have, you know, funding cycles, programming requirements, et cetera, get in the way of doing the next cool, interesting thing.
Right.
And you know, not by thwarting it directly, but just death by a thousand paper cuts.
Mm. And what makes you optimistic?
Right now, I'd say what makes me optimistic within government in Estonia is that we've really gotten to a point where I think top management and below them sort of the service delivery teams really across government gets it. And we put a lot of effort into executive education, into training our civil servants, and not just the technology, but how you do service design, how you think about data. And there's actually like a pretty across-the-board hunger to use the tools we now have to get better business outcomes. So that's the first thing that makes me optimistic. And the second thing that actually makes me optimistic is precisely the fact that we're not sort of the only country in the world that's doing a good job at this. The fact that other countries in a couple of years' time can look at what we've done, learn these lessons, and then kind of catapult themselves into being the same league with us, that gives me ground for optimism that actually governments can get better at this, and that this, you know, there isn't some kind of unique, special to Estonia sort of set of circumstances that doesn't scale. Because that would actually be a really depressing conclusion. If the conclusion is actually anyone can do this and it works for big countries and small countries, I think that's a much more optimistic conclusion.
Indeed. Lukas Ilves, thank you very much for joining me on Have a Nice Future.
Thank you.
So my first question, Lukas sounds like an American. I was expecting an Estonian accent, so this surprised me. Is he also an American?
Well, his father, who was the president of Estonia, then taught at Stanford for a while, and Lukas studied in the U.S.
Okay, so more seriously, I'm still not sure I understand exactly how their data system is so secure, particularly when they do still rely on third-party vendors to power some of these services. How do they make that work?
I mean, granted that I'm not a digital security expert, but it's a system that they've built over a number of decades that is based on this thing they call the X-Road. And what that is simply an agreed platform that no matter what data system you use in whatever government ministry or whatever private company, there is a kind of pipeline that you interface with by an agreed protocol that is secure. And that pipeline is what carries data from one entity's databases to another and what controls who accesses it and how permissions are granted. And so they're using that single protocol for everything, both in the public sector and in the private sector. And they also use a blockchain as a way of making sure that things can't be changed without leaving a trace. So somebody can't interfere with the data and then cover up the interference, that whatever change is made to the data is going to be recorded in the blockchain.
Got it. Okay. So provided that works as promised, it seems like it'd be pretty good for something like voting. Do you think that online voting is a good thing generally? I mean, it has a bad reputation here in the United States. Cybersecurity experts have actively opposed bills that would introduce internet voting because of how insecure they think it is.
Mm.
And I don't know if you recall, but we had a little issue with our last presidential election.
There was something I heard, I think, somewhere on the news. I mean, I think it seems as if Estonia has done quite a bit of work and has taken some time both to build up the trust and to build up the security of its online voting system. But as Lukas said, they now have more than half of the voters voted online in the last election. I think there is another argument that one might make against online voting, which is that voting is seen as a civic duty and as a kind of it's an opportunity for people to come together. You all show up at the voting booth. You're standing in line with other citizens. You get to feel like you're participating in this important democratic process, and that if you just click a button online, maybe it won't have that effect. But I don't know if there's evidence either way that shows that that's true. Mm. We've seen voting rates decline in many, many countries where they have voting in person. So I don't think we can say definitively that online voting makes it worse.
Right. And voting in person also creates opportunities for voter intimidation.
Yeah. One of the things Lucas talked about was how their online voting system allows you to vote as many times as you want, which seems weird and counterintuitive. But what he was saying was, if someone tries to pressure you to vote a certain way or even to bribe you, you could vote the way they want. And then 5 minutes later, you could vote again. And only your last vote counts in the system.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that takes away the incentive to bribe people or to put pressure on them.
Wow. You could change your votes as often as you change your outfits.
Right.
You wake up one day and have a totally different vibe.
Right. But only the last one counts.
I'm intrigued by Lucas's claim that we will get a single electronic identity here in the United States via some sort of backdoor, you know, implemented by tech firms like Apple and Google. People in tech have talked about this idea of federated identity for a long time, but also I'm not sure this should be powered by the private sector. How do you think this would actually work?
It seemed to me that what Lucas was saying was, if you see what Google and Apple, and I think even Microsoft are already doing, they've rolled out these things called passkeys. And the idea of a passkey is, instead of having a password for each site that you log into, your phone or your computer basically authenticates with that site and says, based on this person's fingerprint or their face ID, I can confirm that this is the person who has this identity. And that eliminates the possibility that you might have multiple logins with different emails, some passwords that are compromised, you know, all of that kind of uncertainty. So your phone or your device becomes the identity standard for you. Once that becomes more accepted, it's logical then that government services, banks, everybody else will all start adopting passkeys. And then what happens de facto is that you have a single identity across all of these different services. And that's what I think he meant by this coming in via the back door, that, you know, because the tech firms have built these identity systems for us, we now start to have the possibility to swap information, in theory, between those services if we choose to allow it. And maybe he's suggesting that that's what's eventually going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the one thing that I can get behind that Lucas talked about, automated taxes. I mean, the U.S. government services are pretty digitized at this point. You can buy your marketplace health insurance, file for unemployment, register your car, all that stuff entirely online. But when it comes to tax season, we still have to go looking for our W-2s, our 1099s. We either then file our own taxes using onerous services like TurboTax, or maybe you package all those files neatly and send them off to an accountant who ultimately comes back to you and says, guess what? I need more forms. I kind of want Estonia's version.
Right. So when you said that U.S. government services are already pretty digitized, I think the key difference here between the U.S. and Estonia is here they're digitized, but still siloed. So you still have to have separate data for each of those things that you do online, and that those services don't exchange data with each other, whereas in Estonia they do. But then as for filing taxes, essentially what Estonia does is say, give us access to your bank records and your salary records and everything else. And then we, the government, from that data, create your tax return. So you have to be comfortable with that. Now, I don't see why you wouldn't be, because ultimately mm-hmm. you're giving them all of that information
unless
anyway.
Unless you're Donald Trump, but please continue. mm-hmm.
But yes, you have to now manually go through the process of compiling all of that information and giving it to the government so it can calculate your taxes. So why not just give it to them preemptively and let them do the work? That seems like a great idea to me.
So why don't we have this yet? Why has there not been a candidate for president who has said, I'm going to run on the e-government platform. I'm going to digitize all of this and make your life easier.
Can you imagine what an exciting governing platform that would be in the US? Wouldn't that just bring people out in droves?
I can't recall in recent history any president saying, one of my top priorities is going to be digitizing the government. And I suppose that Barack Obama did this too with healthcare.gov.
Mm. Which was a resounding success.
Ooh, the initial rollout was rough.
Yeah,
painful.
It was a real mess.
Yeah, so why hasn't a candidate done this?
I think part of it is that it's kind of boring as a campaign platform in the US. I mean, the things that get people riled up are the polarizing issues like abortion and taxes and gun control and so on.
Actually, you just made me wonder, what's Estonia's policy on abortion?
I mean, abortion is legal in Estonia. I think the reason this is a worry in the US is that state laws vary. So where an abortion or gun ownership are legal under certain conditions in one state, they might not be in another state. And people who are traveling out of state for an abortion might not want the state they came from to know that they went and got it somewhere else.
Right. So in a totally polarized America, you might have one group of people, let's say gun control activists, who really think it would be beneficial to have a centralized database of every assault weapon in the United States and who owns that weapon and who's in possession of it. At the same time, there might be people who don't believe in abortion, feel strongly it should be illegal, who also think that there should be a database of people who get an abortion. And that's a scary future.
But I think the thing that is often really misunderstood about Estonia's data system, which is why it might also in fact work in the US, is that it is not about necessarily centralizing a database. You could have state-level databases of who's had an abortion or who owns guns. You could even have city-level. And you, as the citizen, would have control over who gets to see the data in your state database. So you could say, I'm from Texas. Texas doesn't have the right to see any abortion data or any health data that I have from another state, for example. That's the way that data is exchanged in the Estonian system. And so that does actually allow for a lot of security. I think the problem with this discussion in the US is it would be very hard to make that clear to people. And I think people would assume that everything is being centralized and everything is being big brothered. You know, I think it's a shame that this conversation is so hard to have in the US, because I actually think a lot of the distrust in government in this country especially is because government services are often so lousy. And making them more digital and making them better connected so you didn't have to spend all your time re-entering data, or you didn't have conflicting versions of your data sitting on different servers, that would actually make it a lot more efficient, a lot more reliable, a lot more easy to use. And it might increase trust in government. But it's very hard to see how you get there politically.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening.
Have a Nice Future is hosted by me, Gideon Litchfield.
And me, Lauren Good. If you like the show, we would love to hear from you. You can leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe so you get our new episodes each week.
You can also email us your comments at nicefuture@wired.com. Tell us what you're worried about, what excites you, any questions you have about the future, and we'll try our best to answer them with our guests.
Have a Nice Future is a production of Condé Nast Entertainment. Danielle Hewitt from Prologue Projects produces the show. Our assistant producer is Arlene Arevalo.
We'll be back here next Wednesday, and until then, have a nice future.